From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, two cover stories. First, college graduates and dropouts alike now owe more than $1 trillion. How did total student debt in America double in a little over a decade? We'll go inside the student debt crisis. Also, once there was a time when politicians disagreed over the same set of facts. Now, there are multiple sets of facts.
I think facts died a long time ago, and it's taken people quite a while to notice.
A look at the life and death of facts, plus the D-Day rehearsal that ended in disaster, remembering the L.A. riots, and how Joel Osteen peered from behind the curtain to become America's pastor.
You know, it sounds weird, but a couple of days after I got over the shock of him dying, I thought, you know what, I'm supposed to pastor this church.
And later, Glee star Chris Colfer on his real-life high school days, and country superstar Carrie Underwood comes back down to earth.
Gosh, like there's a whole world out there, and I'm not seeing it. As soon as I left, all I wanted to do was go home.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
Hey, good girl, with your head in the clouds, I bet you I can tell you what you're thinking about.
In a little more than 10 years, the total amount of student loan debt in this country has doubled, more than $1 trillion today. And in the not-too-distant future, student loan debt will eclipse the amount of money Americans owe on both their cars and credit cards combined. How do we get there, and how do we get out? That's our cover story today. This week, President Obama went to the University of North Carolina.
Hello, North Carolina!
He was there to make the case for keeping interest rates on student loans low.
The interest rates will double unless Congress acts by July 1st.
Well, yesterday, Congress did act. A Republican bill that will keep interest rates on federal student loans at 3.4%. But to finance it, well, Republicans would strip $6 billion from a program within the health care law. So President Obama says he will veto it. But even if those interest rates are kept low, the bigger problem remains. What to do about the soaring costs of college and the related debt obligations that 40 million Americans now carry?
My name is Josh Chisonia, 25 years old. I just graduated last August from the Ohio State University.
Josh owes $26,000 for that education. It's about the average for students who graduated in recent years. Half of those new graduates are either jobless or underemployed, including Josh. He earns about $600 a month working at a local radio station and as a substitute teacher. But his monthly loan payment? $450.
I feel bad. I'm 25, still living with my mom, and she's helping me pay cell phone or just other type of bills I have. But I'm just trying to be optimistic because I know a lot of other people are in my shoes too.
Including Emmanuel Tellez.
I studied English literature at Northeastern University and I graduated in 2008.
He finished school $65,000 in the hole.
I was the first generation of my family to go to college. I'm a first generation American. There was just no way I had any kind of capital support for me to, you know, pay off what's the equivalent of a Lexus right after college.
And so how much of that loan has he paid so far?
I think none of it. I think, if anything, it just kept on growing.
Emmanuel works. He's a legal assistant and earns about $36,000 a year. Many of his loans came from private lenders who then resold those loans to others. And Emmanuel says when he tried to work with them, well,
they were not seriously entertaining the possibility of getting their money at a slower rate. Later on, they demanded too much money from me, which I just couldn't honor it.
So he's currently in default, and he's hired a lawyer to try and help him consolidate.
If you receive this great schooling, but yet you have to, be in suffering a lifetime of indentured servitude, you can't actually say that you benefited from that education.
Now, why does it matter whether Emmanuel or Josh, who we heard from earlier, why does it matter whether they're saddled with debt? Well, most economists, including Chris Derides from Moody's, argue that it means they're unlikely to do things that benefit the overall economy anytime soon, like buy houses or new cars or start families.
There's been a lot of talk of making comparisons of the student loan debt bubble to the subprime mortgage bubble or to the housing bubble. It's not quite to that level, so I don't think this is a bubble that's going to burst and bring down the financial system, but it is something that is going to affect our long-run ability to grow.
We asked NPR's education correspondent, Claudio Sanchez, how we got to the point where 22-year-olds are leaving college with both a degree and also thousands of dollars in crushing debt.
It's been a 30-year process, Guy. I mean, this is the story of how the federal government, in trying to help students go to college, shifted big time away from grants towards loans. Now, the fact that you have this surge, the biggest since 1968 in the last couple of years in college enrollment, mostly of low-income minority students, you now have a higher demand for the kind of aid that the federal government provides. The other story...
And everybody can get it, by
right.
the way.
Well, remember that minority students, certainly low-income minority students in particular, are eligible for grants. I mean, but the grants that they're getting, Pell Grants in particular, used to buy maybe two-thirds of a year's worth of a college education.
Now,
barely a third. That forces them to take out a lot of loans. Some of those are subsidized, some of them are not, some of them are private, some of them are federal, and there's a good chunk of state aid as well.
What effect do you think the increased rate of loans has had on the increased rate of college tuition?
There is a direct link to that, but clearly higher education gets very defensive about that.
Yeah.
They point to the fact that their budgets are being slashed left and right.
Especially obviously, the public institutions.
And that they have no choice but to pass on whatever costs they can't make up with state aid to the student in student fees and student tuition. But you also have stories, of course, of schools that have invested heavily into stadiums, sports. I mean, the schools that try to maintain the brand name, either for academics or athletics, often have little of an excuse to say, well, we could have saved students money by not having to expand our facilities. But again, that wears thin when you do realize that states have cut, on average, in the last couple of years, 24% of higher education funding. And that has hit public institutions like a hurricane.
California, case in point.
That's ground zero for the mess that has been created. You have an economy that is sluggish. You have state funding that is not there for these higher institutions. And we are hammered every day that without a college education, your prospects are pretty poor. It's a conflicting message, though, because at the same time that we're saying you're not going to get anywhere without a college education, you go out into the job market and you find that a lot of people with really pretty good degrees from really good schools are not finding those jobs.
You can't get work and they're saddled with this enormous debt.
That's right. And remember, that debt is here to stay. Unlike the home mortgage crisis, you essentially have to pay this back.
You have
and
to pay
the
back.
Government will come after you. They will garnish your wages. They will take your Social Security money if need be. You know, you're in debt in perpetuity.
That's NPR's Claudio Sanchez. A year at a place like Ohio State is close to $10,000. At a private school, it's more like $50,000. And according to Lindsay Burke, who writes about education for the Conservative Heritage Foundation, the best way to check those skyrocketing costs would be to stop subsidizing student loans with lower interest rates. She argues that subsidized aid feeds a vicious cycle. The government gives out more money for college, so colleges charge more money to attend.
We have seen federal subsidies continue to increase at alarming rates. You look just in recent history from 1982, federal subsidies like Pell Grants, for instance, have increased 475%. We're seeing federal subsidies increase in tandem with cost, and it makes sense because the more you increase federal subsidies, the more you give students this false sense of purchasing power. It allows universities to raise tuition on students and then send students scrambling back for more federal aid. So we need to think about ways to ultimately reduce the college cost problem. We need to start moving toward more online learning options, really kind of pushing that bubble.
So your argument is that if we have more online learning, more what used to be called distance learning, the costs will go down and that will eventually resolve the problem. That's already happening. So I don't understand how making loans more difficult to attain would ultimately have an impact either way.
And it's not necessarily a matter of making loans more difficult to attain. And I think when we look at the ultimate cost to students, President Obama says that if we allow these interest rates to double, that'll add about $1,000 to the cost of a loan. There are some experts who have costed that out and say that an average student pays off a Stafford loan over the course of 12 years. So you're talking about a cost of ultimately about $83 a year, ultimately about $7 a month. And this is passing on an estimated $6 billion to taxpayers in order to keep the rates low. So, you know, when you have Washington in this lending game, this is what you get. You really get these calculations based on politics and not based on what the market would dictate or the risk of the student.
Do you support the idea that every American who wants to should be able to go to college?
I think that every American who thinks that it would be in their best interest, would ultimately help them in their career path down the road, that wants to pursue that, should certainly have access and options. But whether or not President Obama's plan to have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world by 2020, and that is the administration's stated goal, whether or not that is a good plan, pushing every student into college, regardless of what they want to do down the long run, I think that's questionable. And that could even be part of the reason we are where we are today, with so many students, with $1 trillion in student loan debt.
That's Lindsay Burke from the Heritage Foundation. Last month, Michigan Congressman Hanson Clark, a Democrat, introduced the Student Loan Forgiveness Act. It has a simple 10-10 formula. Pay 10% of your salary towards those loans for 10 years, and then it'll all be forgiven. But won't that leave taxpayers on the hook?
First of all, if a borrower pays on their loans according to 10 years based on their income, they're likely not to have much loan debt left over. Second, right now, we're already paying the cost of not having the jobs that could be created by our college graduates who are saddled with all this debt. And the money that I would use to pay off the loans that are going to be forgiven, I'm just redirecting money that we as taxpayers are already spending in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm just taking a fraction of the savings of drawing down our troops to help forgive loans. I mean, that's really in our nation's best interest. When people are not in debt, when they're being productive, that's how this country will become stronger. I mean, that's why this country became great in the first place. It attracted immigrants like my dad. My dad also, by the way, came to this country during the Great Depression, during the midst of the toughest economic time this country had ever seen. But yet, as an immigrant, he saw the U.S. as a place of opportunity. That's what it is. So the cost of forgiving the student loans, that's a minor cost. Instead of spending that money in Iraq and Afghanistan, we'll be redirecting a fraction of the savings to help cover some of the student loan forgiveness.
That's Michigan Congressman Hanson Clark. By the way, for-profit institutions are responsible for the largest share of student loan defaults. Just 9% of college students are enrolled at for-profit universities, but they account for 44% of all student defaults. First to our cover story today, and it begins with sad news of a death. Rex Hupke, a columnist with the Chicago Tribune, broke that news this past week, and that's when I spoke with him.
Thank you for being with us during this difficult time, Rex.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Tell us about the deceased.
Well, Fax, unfortunately, passed away Wednesday, April 18th.
Fax, of course, is not a person. Fax are things we know to be true. And Rex Hupke says, in this day and age, fax are dead.
The final blow came after Representative Alan West down in Florida declared that about 80 Democratic congresspeople were communists. That was the death blow for facts.
Just to review, if you missed that story, Rex Hupke is talking about some comments Republican Alan West, a congressman from Florida, made recently at an event where he was asked how many members of Congress were card-carrying Marxists or international socialists. And here's what he said.
I believe there's about 81 members of the Democrat Party that are members of the Congress Party.
78 to 81 members of the Democratic Party are members of the Communist Party, he said. Now, what's amazing about that clip is that people in the audience gasp. They audibly gasp because they cannot believe what he has just said is true. And, of course, it's not.
Thank you for calling the Communist Party USA.
We called up one of the vice chairs of the Communist Party USA.
For media inquiries or interviews, please press 3.
Libero della Piana. What percentage of the U.S. House of Representatives, of the members there, what percentage of them are card-carrying members of the Communist Party?
That would be a zero.
Zero?
Yeah.
Not a single one?
No.
By the way, do you distribute cards to your members?
Not so much. We have them, but most members don't get a card when they join.
So, not a fact on two counts. There are no communists in the U.S. House of Representatives, but Alan West said so, and he even stood by those comments. So anyway, that's what led Rex Hupke to this idea that if someone of any political party can say something so patently untrue and stand by it, which seems to happen more and more often, then facts must be meaningless, dead.
Who is facts survived by?
Survived by rumor and innuendo, two brothers. and then a sister emphatic assertion.
Well, we're going to explore that idea and find out if facts are dead, what happened, and are they gone forever? We're going to start with someone Rex Hupke spoke to when he was writing his obituary, NYU professor Mary Poovey. He called her up last week.
And he said he was writing an obituary for facts. Well, what did you think?
I thought it was high time. I think facts died a long time ago, and it's taken people quite a while to notice.
Now, Mary Poovey should know she literally wrote the biography on facts. It's called A History of the Modern Fact.
Facts are very old. The concept of a fact goes back to Aristotle, but it wasn't really until the early 17th century that facts began to be used in the sense that we think of facts, which has to do with observable concrete particulars in the real world. Francis Bacon was important for getting people to think about facts as what you could see and eventually what you could measure or count.
In other words, science.
All rock that is formed by fire is called igneous.
Maybe you remember those kinds of facts, but Mary Poovey says that's all they are, memories. And here's how it happened.
I think the first thing that contributed to that was the gradual emergence of mathematical modeling using quantification and mathematics to create a new kind of truth, one that couldn't be observed but could only be modeled.
And that's probably why so many people keep asking economists, why couldn't you tell us what was going to happen?
That's right. And of course, economics was one of the disciplines that used that notion, but it's now used very widely in making statements about climate or making statements about the future of your health care costs and so on. Then I think something else began to happen when the internet made it possible for people to air opinions and to make those opinions seem as credible as scientific truth claims.
I mean, when Francis Bacon was revising and essentially defining our modern understanding of facts, Gutenberg was also revolutionizing print technology. So you would think that facts would be constantly challenged, under challenge.
Well, certainly facts have always been contested. There's no doubt about that. But there's always been relatively high barriers to getting into print. It was a fairly expensive technology. And that means that print, ironically, carried the power to authenticate facts as much as it carried the power to undermine or contest facts.
And so today, with a lot more contested facts floating around, there's a pretty modern job. Organizations where all they do, check facts. Please go ahead and introduce yourself, Bill.
Sure. I am Bill Adair. I am the editor of PolitiFact.com.
Have you guys thought about changing your name to just Politi?
I think whether the fact has actually died or is just on its deathbed, you know, it's a great time to be in the fact-checking business because there are just so many questions about what's accurate and what's not.
In a small office here in Washington, D.C., Bill Adair and some colleagues are on a conference call answering one of those questions.
Does the speaker prove the claim to be true?
Today, they're fact-checking a graphic being posted on Facebook. It lists the top five donors to both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney's presidential campaigns.
All right, any edits?
I did have one.
It is a long and arduous process. Now, when everyone agrees whether the claim is true or half true or not at all, they post the result on their website. But the point is, even when it's over, the people who run PolitiFact, these are journalists with stellar reputations, even Pulitzer Prizes, even they can't always convince people what is true, what is a fact.
What's funny is sometimes I'll get an email that'll say, you guys are so biased, but I won't know who we're supposed to be biased in favor of, because we get criticized a lot by both sides. And I think that's just the nature of a very rough and tumble political discourse. We are in a time when there's more political discourse than ever. It's more passionate than ever. We have a more polarized Congress than ever. And when you hear somebody say your team is wrong, almost like a referee, you're going to argue with the ref. You're going to say the ref is biased.
But there's a problem. Increasingly, people don't just say the ref is biased. They say the ref is lying. A political scientist named Brendan Nyhan and a colleague of his, Jason Riefler, conducted an experiment where they had people read a mock news article about President George W. Bush. The article quoted Bush as saying his tax cuts increased government revenue. And then some of the participants were given a second article, this one with a correction. It said the Bush tax cuts actually led to a decline in tax revenue. Now, those who opposed President Bush were more prone to believing the second article, which happened to be true. Those who supported Mr. Bush, well, even after reading the second corrected article, many were even more likely to believe the first. And Brendan Nyhan, who carried out the research, calls this phenomenon backfire, and it affects people of all political stripes.
In journalism, in health, in education, we tend to take the attitude that more information is better. And so there's been an assumption that if we put the correct information out there, the facts will prevail. Mm. But unfortunately, that's not always true. In some cases, giving people corrective information about a misperception can make the problem worse. It can make them believe in the misperception even more strongly. And this is what we call the backfire effect.
Can you describe a period of time in the political realm, let's say, where everybody agreed on a set of facts, but just sort of, you know, had a difference of philosophy?
You know, I don't think there is this golden age of factual agreement. It's certainly true that in the mid-20th century, the political elites in this country were much less polarized than they are now. And so people weren't getting these sharply divergent cues about what the relevant facts were. But people have always believed incorrect things. Human nature hasn't changed. What's changed is the way our society is structured. And that trend towards polarization, I think, has exacerbated this divergence in factual perceptions to the point that, you know, it seems like we've lost something.
Let's talk about something that Stephen Colbert has coined, this phrase truthiness, right? When he launched his show in 2005, he coined this term truthiness.
Truthiness!
Which seems to capture all of these things that we're talking about.
Because that's where the truth comes from, ladies and gentlemen. The gut. Do you know you have more nerve endings in your stomach than in your head? Look it up. Now, somebody's gonna say, I did look that up and it's wrong. Well, mister, that's because you looked it up in a book.
I think one of the things that's great about that is the idea of something feeling true. So, in a lot of cases, what you see are ideological actors, think tanks, pundits, and so forth, manufacturing the appearance of verisimilitude, right? So things that appear to be scientific. So if you watch negative ads now, they frequently have documentation at the bottom to make them look authoritative, even though that documentation itself may be misleading.
So I guess the question is where is this all headed? It seems like what you're saying is we are just headed or we are in a factless world.
Well, it's simply too hard to walk back misperceptions once they're out there. To give you one example, the weapons of mass destruction misperception stuck around for years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq. You know, a lot of the action here is at the elite level. If people pay a reputational price for putting these claims out there, maybe there'll be fewer of them in the first place. That, to me, is a difficult problem, but certainly an easier one than trying to change human nature, which is what you're talking about when you try to talk about convincing people, you know, at the mass level to change their mind. It's just too difficult most of the time.
Brendan Nyhan, he's a professor at Dartmouth, and he also covers New Hampshire politics for the Columbia Journalism Review. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News, and that's a fact. 68 years ago today, the Allies launched a massive dress rehearsal for the invasion of Normandy, the famous D-Day landings that would happen 5 weeks later. But that rehearsal turned into one of the war's biggest fiascos, and it took place on Slapton Sands, a beach in southwestern England.
And the beaches there are long and they're wide, so it gave the soldiers plenty of opportunity to really experience what it was going to be like, because the beaches in the west of England are almost identical to the beaches in Normandy.
That's British historian Giles Milton. He wrote about what was called Operation Tiger on his blog last week. The idea was to get landing boats into the English Channel and then have them simulate a water landing on the beaches of Devon. The man in charge, the great Allied commander, Dwight Eisenhower.
So he wanted to put them out in the rough waters of the Channel, have them shaken around, you know, seasickness, everything else that soldiers are prone to. And then the idea was for these ships and tank landing craft involved in this operation to bring them up towards Slapton Sands, where there was going to be shellfire and gunfire, so the men were going to land in real battlefield conditions.
But to make sure the men would be safe and that the mission would be effective, Allied Command had to keep the operation a secret, even from their own men.
They told us nothing. They told us absolutely nothing. We didn't know anything.
That's 91-year-old Paul Gerolstein. He was a gunner's mate on one of those landing ships, LST-515. 300 Allied ships were sent into the English Channel, and around midnight, April 28, 1944, they started to approach the British shores.
A German patrol fleet is out in the English Channel, and quite by chance, it picks up on its radar this enormous flotilla of vessels and dramatically and suddenly launches attacks on some of the easy pickings of this flotilla.
A flare broke over our head, over our ship. I said, oh my God, we're going to get it. And apparently we didn't. It must have gone under. See, because LST was a flat bottom boat. I looked to the stern and I saw LST 531 or 532 get torpedoed.
The torpedoes tear into these vessels and literally blow them apart. They all catch fire and there's complete carnage, pandemonium, men on fire, tanks on fire, the ships on fire, and of course, the ships starting to sink.
The Allied commanders monitoring from London ordered all the boats to scatter immediately. They hoped to avoid any more direct hits from the Germans. But that order left hundreds of men floating in the icy sea. Paul Gerolstein's commanding officer refused the order, and he turned his boat back to help rescue the men still in the water.
And we put cargo nets over the side. I went down the cargo net to the last hole. I put my leg through one and my arm through another one. And as they came by, we'd grab them and pull them onto the net, and they could work their way up.
All told, Paul and the rest of the crew managed to save 70 or 80 lives.
When we got back and then the light broke, you could walk across the dead bodies in the water. There was over 700 of them killed.
But that wasn't the end. Many of the ships continued on to the beach at Slapton Sands. Eisenhower had ordered live fire to be used in the rehearsal because he wanted to simulate real-world conditions.
Now, the idea was that the shelling would stop very, very shortly before the American soldiers came on shore, so that the wreckage of war would still be around, the smells of the war, the sounds, the shell-blasted beach would be there. But there was a terrible mix-up of timings, which meant that as the American soldiers came onto the shore, the British were still shelling the beach, which meant that the Americans came under devastating friendly fire from the British.
Within a few minutes, 300 more American troops were dead. Paul Gerolstein helped ferry some of those wounded to a hospital.
The orders were in the hospital, you will not ask these men anything. You will not ask them anything. You'll just take care of them.
By the time it was over, close to 1,000 American troops were killed.
It's a staggering figure, and all the more staggering when you realize that more people were killed in the rehearsal for the landing at Utah Beach than were killed in the actual landing at Utah Beach.
For nearly 40 years, Operation Tiger remained a secret.
Allied Command did not want the bulk of the troops about to risk their lives going over to Normandy, knowing of this disaster that had unfolded in the West Country of England.
Giles Milton says the disaster prompted Allied commanders to order better life preservers, but most importantly, to fix their broken system of communication.
All radio frequencies between all the different command structures and all the different ships involved in the D-Day landings, all these radio frequencies were standardized so that this miscommunication could never happen on the big day itself.
That's historian Giles Milton. He's the author of The Boy Who Went to War. Today, on that beach at Slapton Sands, there is a small memorial to the 946 men who lost their lives that day, April 28, 1944. 68 years ago today. Back here at home, today, of course, marks 20 years since the city of Los Angeles erupted in 6 days of rioting. It happened a few hours after a jury acquitted four L.A. police officers in the beating of the black motorist Rodney King. We called up a few Angelenos who were recently profiled in Los Angeles Magazine to hear their recollections of those devastating days. We begin with Ted Soke, a freelance photographer who was working for the LA Weekly newspaper at the time. That day, he was buying film at a camera store.
I didn't know it would be the last film I'd be able to buy for a long time. But the manager yelled to everybody in the store, "We are now closed." And I thought I heard something. And I go, "Why? You guys are a 24-hour camera store. Why are you closing?" He goes, "Well, somebody just drove by and just shut up the store." And like the sound I heard was gunfire.
For the next 5 days, Ted Soke spent nights developing photos in his garage. Other photographers were being beaten, so Ted figured out a way to keep a low profile.
So I'm thinking, okay, take off my press credentials. I took a paper bag, because everybody was carrying bags, and they were looting, and I just figured I could blend in if I carry a bag and put a hole in it, and I would cover the hole with my hand. If I saw something, I'd remove my hand from the hole and take a quick picture, and then to work in a situation that could get you killed or beaten up or both.
Also that day, Titus Murphy was driving through the mayhem of South Central L.A. with his girlfriend when they happened upon a truck driver, Reginald Denny, and he was badly beaten. He was cowering in the back of his truck, and there was no one at the wheel. After Titus saw him, he ran to his car and told his girlfriend he was going to drive the truck to the hospital.
And as I was running back to the truck, I noticed that there was a tall figure running to the truck as well. And he went to the driver's side, so I ran back to the passenger side again, stood on the running boards. And I asked him, "What are you going to do?" Because I thought I would have to fight this guy. And I guess he was thinking the same thing as I was, that he would have to take me on. And then at that moment, he told me he was a truck driver. And I thought, wow, that's it. Let's go.
They drove toward Daniel Freeman Hospital, and when they got there, Titus ran for some nearby paramedics.
And he came over to the truck. They placed him on a gurney, laid him on his back, and as soon as they laid him on his back, he started having convulsions, blood coming out of his mouth like it was under pressure. Just coming out of his mouth about a foot above his head right there. And that's when he realized that while we saved his life, because in a minute or two later, he would have been already passed away.
Rhonda Mitchell was working as a 911 operator for the city of Los Angeles at the time. She was actually at work when she heard the verdict on the radio.
I was so disappointed. I was so angry. And I just unplugged my headset and I just sat there for a minute. The verdicts came down that afternoon, and at 6 a.m. the next day I was back at work and fielding 911 calls from people that were sounding very desperate. Their businesses were burning, or they were being looted, or they were hearing gunshots. And most of my response, which is really sad, and it was that the police couldn't respond.
A few days in, police set up a command center in the heart of an area that had seen heavy riots and violence, and they asked Rhonda to go.
And I said, "Oh yeah, sure, I'll go." And they said, "We want you to wear your uniform." And I said, "Absolutely not." So I ended up going and working the command center, but I did not wear my uniform.
There was something else that happened that night, April 29th, 1992. A small miracle that, if it happened at any other time, would probably go down in L.A. sports history as one of the great moments. I remember it because I was there.
Their Lakers still have a little heart.
That night, the L.A. Lakers were about to be eliminated from the NBA playoffs. The fact that they had even made it was something of a miracle. At the beginning of the season, Magic Johnson announced he was HIV positive and that he'd step aside from basketball. But somehow, the Lakers still made it to the playoffs without him. The Portland Trailblazers destroyed the Lakers in games 1 and 2. Game 3 was to be the end of the season. But with heart and courage, the Lakers took the game into overtime.
We're going to overtime!
And with 6 seconds left, Sadale Threet hit a free throw, putting the Lakers up by 2. The crowd at the Forum went wild. I Love L.A. blared from the loudspeakers. 25,000 people chanted, "We love it, we love it, we love it." With 5 seconds left, Portland's Clyde the Glide Drexler went for a three-pointer.
He will take a three, and it almost went. The tip, no. The Lakers are still alive.
And the Lakers stayed alive for a few more days. And in that arena that night, for those few moments, L.A. felt like there was nothing that could tear it apart.
And only when my dad and I walked out of the forum, still flying high from that victory, could we see that it was an illusion. The city was on fire, and it was tearing apart. Joel Osteen is one of the most influential religious figures in the world. His Sunday sermon at Lakewood Church in Houston is beamed to more than 10 million households in America and is seen in 100 countries around the world. Part of what makes Joel Osteen so popular is his message, but probably more importantly, his style. There is no fire and brimstone, not even a whole lot of scripture, almost no talk of sin, and definitely no politics. Joel Osteen is at the vanguard of what's come to be known as motivational preaching. And for that reason, he's easy to like. Here's how he began a recent sermon.
I heard about this 92-year-old man. He wasn't feeling up to par, and he went to the doctor for a checkup. A few days later, the doctor saw him out walking in the park. And he had this beautiful young lady by his side, and he seemed as happy as can be. And the doctor said, "Wow, you sure are feeling a lot better, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, doctor, I'm just taking your orders. You said get a hot mama and be cheerful." The doctor said, "I didn't say that. I said you got a heart murmur. Be careful." Hold up your Bible.
Joel Osteen stopped by our studios earlier this week. He's in Washington, D.C. now, where tomorrow night he'll speak to a capacity crowd at the baseball stadium here in Nationals Park. For 17 years, Osteen worked behind the scenes at the church. He produced his father's televised sermons, and he says he never intended to become a pastor, even though Osteen's father, John, encouraged it.
He tried to get me up there to minister many, many times.
He asked you. He would say, "Joel, just give it a try."
He would. He said, "You'd be a good minister, I could tell, but I'm naturally more quiet and reserved, and every once in a while I'd go up and make some announcements or something, and I would stumble. I was so nervous I didn't want to do it, but the week before he died, and of course we didn't know he was going to die, he asked me to minister, and I did that Sunday. And I thought, well, I'll do it one time and just make my father happy. Little did I know that next Friday he had a heart attack and died. And so, you know, it sounds weird, but a couple of days after I got over the shock of him dying, I thought, you know what, I'm supposed to pastor this church. And I'd only spoken one time.
That was 1999. You were 36 or 37.
That's right.
And what happened? You went from being nervous and stumbling to just switching on, being able to do it right away?
It wasn't overnight, but I think there was what I like to see, and I encourage other people, is, you know, God puts things in us we don't know we have, and sometimes God has to push us into our destiny, and sometimes it's through adversity. What I thought would be my darkest hour, it launched me into my brightest hour.
Joel Osteen, your church has now become the largest in the United States. You did that. I mean, your father begun this church, but you made it what it is today. 16,000 seats in the arena, what used to be a sports arena, where you preach. That is a lot of people, millions watching around the world. How are you able to connect with all of those people watching you in those chairs and the millions watching you on television?
When I prepare my messages, I always act like I'm talking to one person. Hmm. And I also, after every service back at home, I'll talk to 500 visitors, just greeting them. And I get to hear their stories. What are they going through? What are their victories? What are their challenges? And so when I sit down to write my messages, I always think, okay, here's who I'm talking to. You know, no matter who we are, we have relationship issues and, you know, health issues and financial issues. And so, you know, I try to talk about how do you keep a good attitude when times are tough, or how do you forgive when somebody did you wrong? So I think talking about everyday life, you know, it resonates with people. I think that's the difference.
You don't talk a whole lot about sin. You don't quote from Scripture all the time. A lot of what you talk about is being positive. Your latest book is about how to be happy or how to think of every day as Friday. How did you develop that message? I mean, how did you come to focus on what some of your greatest fans and your critics, as you know, have called a form of positive psychology?
Sure. You know, when I first started, you may find this interesting. When I first started, I tried to kind of be like my dad because, you know, he was a Southern Baptist, raised Southern Baptist, and he, you know, he had his certain style, and people had heard him for 40 years there at the church, and I thought, I got to be like my dad. They came to hear him. In the first few months, I was trying to find myself, but when I really stepped into who I believe God made me to be, and that is encouraging people, talking about everyday life, I didn't feel like, you know what, I don't have to quote 22 scriptures like my dad. I don't have to have the text exactly like him. I'm just going to try to do what I'm good at. And, you know, my thought was, if it doesn't work, I'll go back to TV production. You know, it wouldn't be the first thing I failed at. But the point being is, I just ran my race and I didn't try to copy my dad or fit into the pressure or the mold that everybody tried to make me fit into.
And you are not formally trained.
I'm not. I've never been to seminary. You know, I do say that those 17 years when my father would preach one of his messages, I would listen to it over and over to edit it down for the television program because I was editing it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to follow trains of thoughts and stories and scripture. So, in a sense, I was hands-on trained, but not formally.
You are one of the most influential religious figures in this country, whether you want to be or not, as you have been made aware. But unlike many of your peers, you haven't come out in support of a particular political party or talked a whole lot about gay marriage or abortion. Why do you shy away from taking positions on some tough issues?
You know, the reason I do is because I feel like I'm called to reach a broad amount of people. When you start getting political, almost immediately you divide 50-50. And so I don't want them to think, well, he's Democrat or Republican or for this or for that. Then half of them are going to turn you off. So that's really the reason, not wanting to divide the people.
Do you think both of the candidates running for president, President Obama and his eventual challenger, Mitt Romney, do you think both of them are Christians?
I do think they are. Mitt Romney, of course, is a Mormon, and some people debate whether or not that's Christian. But when somebody believes that Jesus is the Son of God and raised from the dead and believes he's their Savior, to me, that's good for me. And so, and of course, I've heard President Obama, been with him in the Easter fellowships where he talks about his faith. So I do believe they both know the Lord.
Your father always wanted you to be a pastor, even though you didn't. You became one. You and your wife, Victoria, have two children of your own. Is that something you would want for either of your kids?
In terms of following in our footsteps, yeah, I would love that. You know, I would love that. Again, I'm going to do like my parents. I'm not going to obviously force them, but, you know, I just think there's something about heritage and legacy. Now, you know, my son loves filmmaking. Maybe he'll be a great filmmaker and spread hope and love and, you know, God's message that way. I don't know. I mean, the ultimate thing would, hey, come follow after me and take this and take it much, much further than I did.
What is the one thing that you think everybody needs to do every single day to achieve happiness?
I think the one thing would be to find something to be grateful for. I think when you're grateful, it's hard to be unhappy. So I always tell people, if you get up in the morning and you know what, don't start the day off thinking about all your problems and it's raining and I got to go to work. Get up and think, okay, you know what, I'm grateful that I'm alive, or I can breathe without pain, or I've got healthy children. Get the day started off in a grateful attitude. It helps the day to go better.
Well, Pastor Osteen, I know that your time is short, and thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
That's Joel Osteen. He's the pastor of Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas. His new book is called Every Day of Friday, and he'll be hosting America's Night of Hope at Nationals Park tomorrow, right here in Washington, D.C. If you watch Glee, then you're very likely a fan of Chris Colfer. He plays Kurt, an openly gay, super confident high school student who's a member of the Glee Club. Colfer is just a few years out of high school himself. He grew up in Clovis, California. That's a small town outside of Fresno. And coincidentally, his new film, Struck by Lightning, takes place in a fictional town called Clover, California. Colfer not only stars in the film, he also wrote it. It's a dark comedy about an ambitious high school senior who starts a literary magazine and who blackmails the popular kids to force them to write for it.
As you all know, I am starting a school literary magazine.
You want us to buy your magazine?
You, Claire? No. I would never expect you to recognize an intelligent publication, let alone purchase one. But your friends and families? Yes. Why? Because you're all going to be in it.
Chris Colfer was himself the editor of his high school literary magazine, but he insists this film is not autobiographical, even though he knows a thing or two about the art of blackmail.
When I was in high school, we had this thing called the Senior Project every year, where one senior was selected every year to kind of have their own show. And all the seniors before me always just did like an SNL-type format with a bunch of skits and gags and songs. And I was the only student that ever was like, nope, I'm going to write a show and we're going to do a full production. And all my classmates had major senioritis and didn't want to participate, so I kind of used things against them to get them to participate in my show. So that's kind of where it came from.
I hope I'm not giving too much away here, but your character in Struck by Lightning, Carson, dies right at the beginning.
Right. Yeah, it's fun, isn't it?
And then we sort of get the backstory up until that point. Why did you decide to start it that way?
One of the biggest things that I wanted to do is have a character call these people out on their fake grief and mourning. And how many times are we, like, you know, at someone's funeral and someone speaks at the podium and we think, oh my God, they're such a liar. They never knew them like I knew them. They weren't as close as they're saying they are. I think one of my character's lines in the movie is, it's amazing how popular you become once you die. I just thought it'd be a great way to tell the story from that perspective of being dead.
The character Carson is obviously sort of a precocious high school student. He's not very well liked,
no.
But he's, you know, doesn't hide his feelings, and he sort of tussles with administrators and fellow students. He's kind of manipulative, but he is likable. I mean, does he in any way resemble the way you were in high school?
Absolutely not. In fact, I was a major pushover in high school. And he really is the person that I kind of created in my head that I wish I was. I really wish I could be like that and say exactly what I meant, exactly when I felt it. But alas, I was not.
The character in the film Struck by Lightning is different from the character you play on Glee, Kurt. But they are similar in the sense that both of them are bullied in school.
Right.
And I know you've talked about this in the past. It's something that you actually kind of went through yourself in junior high and in high school as well, right?
Yeah. When I was in seventh grade, I was homeschooled for the second half of my seventh grade year and eighth grade year because I was really kind of made the target of by a lot of students. And I was having, like, my locker vandalized and my PE clothes stolen, and my mom and my dad finally got sick of it and homeschooled me for the rest of junior high. But then I went back to high school.
I'm speaking with the actor Chris Colfer. He's the star, of course, of the hit TV show Glee, about his new film. It's called Struck by Lightning. Let me ask you about your character on Glee, Kurt. You were 19 years old when you were cast as Kurt in Glee. That role was actually written for you by the show's creator, Ryan Murphy. And a lot of critics and a lot of fans of the show have commented on the fact that it's really one of the first times on television where you have a gay teenage character who's three-dimensional.
Yeah.
Who's not like a caricature.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much of that is you and how much of that is the script?
I don't know. I mean, I would hate not to give the completely deserved credit that the writers deserve for really building that character up. I know that when I went into the project, I was coming from such a very, very, very conservative hometown. I was very, very kind of nervous about playing a gay character, and I kind of went into it knowing that I wanted to make him more than just the punching bag that gay characters usually are on TV, you know, the quirky best friend with the one-liners that we see on almost every other show. So I definitely wanted to make him more than what characters like him had been before, and I think thanks to the writing I was able to.
In the first season, Kurt comes out to his father, Bert, who is played by the actor Mike O'Malley. Let's hear a bit of that scene for a moment.
Dad, being a part of the Glee Club and football has really showed me that I can be anything. And what I am is I'm gay.
I know.
Really?
I've known since you were three. All you wanted for your birthday was a pair of sensible heels. I guess I'm not totally in love with the idea, but if that's who you are, there's nothing I can do about it. And I love you just as much. Okay?
Going into that scene, there have been a lot of scenes like that in television before where kids come out to their parents. And for one, I love the fact that the father was accepting of it. I mean, that was groundbreaking right there. I also really wanted to take it from a very real perspective, because a lot of times those scenes, the kids, you know, are very, I'm queer, I'm here, and I'm proud of it, you know, and that's not the case when kids come out to their parents. It's terrifying, especially at an early age. So I really just wanted to make sure there was a lot of honesty in that scene, and it wasn't so forced or arrogant, but it really was just this kid that was terrified of telling his father the truth.
You you are, of course, gay, and you came out to your parents as well in high school, I understand. Were your parents, did they accept it immediately?
My parents would tell you that, like, from the minute I was born, they knew that I was different. And I mean, like, I joke now because now it makes sense that I wrote a screenplay, but that I would sit in my room and I would write for hours and hours while their kids were out and about. So they always just kind of let me do my thing, and there was never really anything that I ever had to ask for acceptance. I just was my own beast, and they just let me be.
Last season on Glee, you sang "As If We Never Said Goodbye" from Sunset Boulevard.
I'm coming out of makeup. It's already burning. Not long until the camera.
cameras will start turning, and the early morning madness and the magic in the making. Yes, everything's as if we never said goodbye.
Now, I know that your whole life, your voice, the pitch of your voice is something that you were teased for, bullied about, but of course, now it's one of the reasons why you're able to sing this way and sort of be the character that you are on the show.
Yeah, thanks. It's crazy. A voice that was never wanted has become a voice for so many people who don't have one.
Has it made you think differently about it?
Yes, and actually, one of the best stories I've ever been told, I was told a story about a little boy with autism named Spence, who thinks when people are speaking in lower tones, that means that they're mad at him. And so he really, really relates to me and looks up to me because I have a high-pitched voice, so he thinks I'm happy all the time. And that type of story, when you're affecting people like that, I mean, that how can you be mad at your voice for when it's affecting kids like that? I get a little choked up thinking about it.
I read that now that you have this film out, you've been signed to a book deal to write novels for young adults. I mean, you're 21, almost 22. What's your ultimate goal?
I would love to retire by the time I'm 25, because by then I probably won't be considered relevant anymore and no one is going to care about me. And I'm very, very well aware that, you know, every actor has a shelf life, and I'm just trying to squeeze as much as I possibly can while I can.
That's actor Chris Colfer. He stars on the hit TV show Glee, as well as in the new film Struck by Lightning, which he also wrote. It's playing at the Tribeca Film Festival and will be released wider later this year. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And it's time now for music. This is the first single off country superstar Carrie Underwood's new album, Blown Away.
Hey, good girl, with your head in the clouds.
Since she burst onto the scene after winning American Idol in 2005, Carrie Underwood's gone on to become one of the most successful country artists in history. In fact, she's now tied with Reba McEntire for the female country artist with the most number one hits. Not too bad for a girl from Chicota, Oklahoma. And unlike her previous records, on this one, Carrie Underwood wanted to go a bit darker.
You know, to be able to explore that side and kind of have a little more drama, a little more ominous, you know, weather going on in the album is really nice.
Speaking of weather, there are a lot of references to where you are from, Oklahoma, which, of course, has been in the news lately because, of course, the storms and tornadoes. In the song Blown Away, which is the title track off the record, you sing, "There's not enough wind in Oklahoma to rip the nails out of the past." What is that song about?
And the song is a story about a girl and her father who, the song describes him as a mean old mister, and you can kind of make that as bad, I guess, as you want it to be. You know, the daughter wishes that, you know, she can feel a storm coming, and she just wishes it would wash her passed away, and in doing so, you know, take her father along. So it's a very, you know, just deep, dark story, and it's so visual, the song is. You know, when you hear the words and you hear the music, you can just see it all happening in your head.
She locked herself in a cellar, listen to the screaming of
How often do you think, I grew up in the middle of Oklahoma, 100 plus miles from Oklahoma City, on a farm. I am now the biggest female artist in country music. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, my life has been pretty nuts ever since I tried out for American Idol, and I certainly never could have imagined any of this was ever possible.
I mean, you sang as a kid, and in fact, you almost got signed as a kid, But you were a good student. You graduated high school or a salutatorian, and you went on to college having no interest in pursuing music. That wasn't what you were going to do.
I mean, it definitely would have been awesome, but that's just not real, right? There's so many people in this world who are absolutely amazing vocalists and writers and musicians, and they never get their shot, you know? So why would I be any more special?
So what changed? When did you decide, you know what, I'm going to take a shot at music again. I'm going to try out for the show American Idol.
I went home to visit my mom and dad. On the news, they just had shots of people sleeping outside in Cleveland getting ready to try out for American Idol. And I went and got on the computer and saw where the auditions were going to be taking place, and then asked my mom how far St. Louis was from us, because I had no idea. I'd never been to St. Louis before. And she was like, oh, it's about, you know, 7 hours plus away. And I said, oh, okay, never mind. And she said, why? And I said, because that's the closest place to us that they're holding American Idol auditions. Later on, I had totally forgotten about it. And she came up to me and said, you know, if you want to go, I'll drive you.
Wow.
She actually kind of had to talk me into it, because I was like, no, that's stupid. It's stupid. No, 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 no. What are the chances? No.
You eventually went to L.A. for Idol. You had never been on an airplane.
Yeah. I was 21 years old, and we'd never gone anywhere. I'd never been on an airplane before, and then it was, all right, here's your ticket, and you're going alone to Los Angeles. And my mom, I remember before I left, she was like, now don't do any drugs, and don't go anywhere by yourself, because it just sounds so far away, and it sounds so scary, especially for, you know, I'm sure your baby daughter to be going off to this giant city all by herself.
It was an incredible moment that season, because Simon Cowell, long before you won, he looked at you and he said, she's going to win.
Yeah, and that was scary, actually. We still had a long way to go in the competition. It's not like there were three or four of us left. There were several of us left, and he says that. And I thought, oh gosh, all the other contestants are going to hate me now. But yeah, I guess he was right.
I'm speaking with country singer Carrie Underwood. Her new record is called Blown Away, and it's out May 1st. Carrie, on this record, you have a song called Forever Changed, and it is a love song, but it's a complex love song. There is a story behind it.
It is. I mean, the love song is mainly, you know, from the singer's point of view, from my point of view, I'm singing about the love I have for my mother and the loves that she had in her life.
She remembers the nights he'd come calling, his yellow silk tie. In love she saw him falling for her in the fire of July.
You know, the mother goes on, she gets married, she has a baby, me, and then you know, at the end she can't remember much. And one of the writers of the song, it was basically about his mom who had Alzheimer's and him watching her go through that.
Forever changed.
It's such a beautiful song, but I've read that you don't think you could ever perform this, that you'd get too emotional.
I just feel like I would be messing up the song if I did that. It's one that you listen to in a quiet moment, you know, in a quiet setting, and where you can really dive into the words. So I just don't feel it's right in a giant arena setting.
You've said that with this record you wanted to change things up, that you felt like you needed to step away from the celebrity bubble. And to have real things to write about, real things to sing about. Where did you feel you were that you wanted to step away from?
Well, I mean, you just get so caught up in all the things that you're doing and in the way people treat you. And, you know, this whole celebrity thing is a wonderful and strange thing. It can be so much fun, but it's just not reality.
But because of your celebrity and because of the millions of people who listen to your music and buy your records, do you have to work really hard to remind yourself of where you come from and who you are in order not to become, you know, that thing that you fear?
You know, my husband and I are still money conscious, and we still live well within our means. I was doing an interview like a week ago, and somebody like was kind of laughing at me, and they said, last time I talked to you, you were driving a Ford Escape. What do you drive now? And I said, Ford Escape.
It's a good car, by the way.
I know, and I've had it for a few years, and I'll have it for a few more. Like, I don't understand why people just automatically expected me to be driving a Porsche or something. I don't know.
This record, and in fact a lot of your music, is about home. You even have a song about hometowns, and you sing, because when you're lost in this crazy world, you've got somewhere to go. Is that how you feel about your hometown, about Chocoda, Oklahoma?
It is. You know, my parents still live in Chocoda, and that line about thank God for county lines that welcome you back in when you were dying to get out, that was me, you know? I'd sit around, and everyone does this. There's always nothing to do in your town, right?
Hmm.
So when I was younger, I would just think, oh my gosh, like there's a whole world out there, and I'm not seeing it. I'm here, you know, I can't wait to leave. And as soon as I left, all I wanted to do was go home.
Thank God for the county lines that welcomed you back in when you were dying.
Well, Carrie Underwood, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's country singer Carrie Underwood. Her new record is called Blown Away, and it's out this Tuesday, May 1st.
Because when you're lost out in this crazy world, you got somewhere to go and get found. Thank God for hometowns.
For the week ending April 29th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Brent Bachman and produced by Walter Ray Watson. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Becky Sullivan. Lauren Beneshew is our intern. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor. And Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the program on your local public radio station. It airs in most places at 5 or 4 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. Thanks for tuning in.